Welcome to the Christian Mysticism Podcast, where we explore the fascinating history of Christian mysticism from the early days of the church until today. I'm Alberto de la Cruz, and I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Carlos Ayer, the T. Lawrison Riggs Professor of History and Religious Studies at Yale University. Welcome back, Carlos.
Hey, it's always good to be here with you. Always.
The feeling is mutual, and I want to welcome all of our listeners who have been listening to us over the past almost year and a half, and we do appreciate all your comments, your emails, and if you haven't done so, please click the like button and the subscribe button so more people can hear about us and enjoy the show. And before we get started today, I just wanted to make an announcement. We're going to be switching up the schedule on the Christian Mysticism Podcast starting this month, and we're switching to a one episode a month format. So this will be the episode for May, and starting in June, we'll be releasing a new episode on the third Thursday of every month. So the show will continue once a month with some great topics, some great mystics, and some great history on Christian mysticism. So who do you have for us today, Carlos?
Well, we have someone who was a pioneer in the study of mysticism, Evelyn Underhill, an English woman who lived from 1875 to 1941. And, well, she was born under Queen Victoria and died in the second year of the Second World War. Being a pacifist, she was a pacifist. She was just so thoroughly devastated by the outbreak of the war. I've read some interpretations of her death, you know, that maybe it was too heartbreaking for her, and it kind of hastened her departure. But pioneer for sure, in so many different ways. And actually, one of her books that we'll cover is the first book I ever read on mysticism. And she's still being read, and she's still a towering figure in the study of mysticism. Among other things, she was the first woman to lecture to clergy in the Church of England, and the first woman to officially conduct spiritual retreats within the Church of England. She was also the first woman to establish ecumenical links between churches at a time when that was not very common. As a matter of fact, it was resisted. And if that's not enough, she was one of the first woman theologians to lecture in English colleges and universities, which she did frequently. And she was a laywoman in both senses of the word. Of course, she was not an ordained cleric. The Church of England did not ordain women back then. And she was not a trained scholar. She received some honorary doctorates later in life, but she was not an academic. And she dared to write and publish about the devotional heritage of Western Christians with great authority, and in some cases surpassing clerics and scholars who had long dominated the study of religion. That book I just mentioned, the first book I ever read on mysticism, published in 1911, is still being read, and to some extent, she can be considered one of the sources of the vast flood of literature on mysticism that began to appear in the 20th century and continues to flow from presses. And as an Anglican, she dared to think and pray ecumenically and to reach back to the church's complete past, including, of course, all of the medieval and early modern mystics, which the Protestant Reformation and the Church of England had set aside. It's so remarkable in so, so many different ways.
Was she herself a mystic?
I think so, and many others also think so. But, you know, again, almost every week I say the same thing. This is an unusual mystic because it doesn't fit the mold. There are so many different kinds of mystics. For one thing, she was married. She and her husband never had any children, but she was married, and she lived an, let's call it, ordinary life. She was not a nun, of course. And she had obviously, in some of her letters, we get clues. In her own words, in one letter she wrote to someone, that when she was very, very young, not specifying her exact age, but very, very young, she began to have, and I'm quoting, abrupt experiences of the peaceful, undifferentiated plane of reality, like the quote-unquote still desert of the mystic, in which there was no multiplicity nor need of explanation, and perhaps also no ability to fully explain. So apophatic, unitive experience as a young person. And her letters are full of comments of this sort that prove to me, at least, that she understood mysticism as a mystic. And then if you read all her other literature, you see that she really not only became an expert, that she had read so many of these key texts for other mystics, but she understood them in a very profound way. Plus, in all of her work, she argues for the reality of these experiences, right? She's not just writing as an academic about mystic so-and-so and mystic so-and-so and describing and analyzing. She is deeply into it and considers it something very real, which in the early 20th century, you know, over 100 years ago, the growth of secularism had already begun to stun many believers, how fast secularism was taking over, and unbelief, and even full-blown materialism and atheism. Here comes this laywoman who says, hey, wake up, this is real. And not only real, but wonderful. It's the real essence of Christian spiritual life, and the very essence of Christian ethics, too. We'll get to that in a minute or two. So, yes, I think she was a mystic, but not of the sort that one would associate with mysticism or some of the other individuals we have covered. What about the physical phenomena of mysticism? No, she's not known as a levitator or bilocator or receiving the stigmata or anything of that sort, but the experiences themselves, definitely.
Listening to you talking now about her understanding of mysticism and understanding of what the mystics were talking about and her experiences that she noted in a letter from early in her youth. And something came to mind, and I wanted to get your take on it. I wonder how many people have had mystical experiences, not necessarily, as you say, of the physical phenomena, but more of a spiritual mystical experience. How many people have had mystical experiences and didn't know they had a mystical experience?
Well, they might have not known the term. But yeah, I think it's not only highly possible, but I think it's a definite yes to the answer. Yes, I think there are probably untold numbers of individuals who have had and continue to have mystical experiences, but may not know that what they're experiencing has been classified by scholars and church leaders as mystical. Absolutely. What is religious experience? It's a very good question that you ask. It's a great question. Because what is religious experience? I think all religious experience, the experience of another reality, and I'll put a capital R on reality, something beyond the mundane, something spiritual. It's a spectrum. And they're all different, as in any spectrum, all different sorts of experiences. I've never seen anyone write in this way, classifying mysticism by numbers. This is a 2 on the mystical scale. This is a 7. Here's a 10 on the mystical scale. No, but in fact, if you view the spectrum as a scale, right, it keeps going up and up and up and up and up. Yeah, there are high experiences and ones that are so intermingled with the mundane that, yes, there are many mystics. And that's something I've said many times before. We don't really know how many people have ever had mystical experiences within the Christian religion, let alone in other religions throughout human history. I think mysticism is the epicenter of all religions, because what is religion? Religion is admitting, believing, and experiencing that there is another reality. In Western culture, often labeled a higher reality in both senses of the term higher, back when heaven was believed to be really above the earth's atmosphere, and also higher in the sense of intensity or value.
I'm reminded now of an experience I had when I was a teenager, and I remember lying in bed. It was late at night. Everybody in the house was asleep. I can't recall exactly what trouble I was going through. I'm sure it was typical teenager problem that the world's about to end. But I was laying in bed praying to God for help and get me through this, and I don't know what I'm going to do. And as I mentioned, everybody's asleep. It's late at night. Lights are out. Everything is quiet. And as I'm praying, all of a sudden, I smell this incredible fragrance, like a perfume, like the sweetest, most wonderful perfume I've ever smelled in my life. I've never smelled anything like that before. It just filled the room. And I got this sudden peace when I smelled that fragrance.
Isn't that something?
It's like I knew it was, this is God. God is present here with me right now. And as soon as it arrived, it was gone.
But isn't that something?
I never thought about it as a mystical experience, but it was a mystical experience because I, for all intents and purposes, I got to smell the fragrance of God.
Well, you know, the sensory dimension of religion, and especially of mysticism, you read enough mystical texts and you see that it's real. That, you know, the five senses can be drawn into the supernatural realm. All five senses, you know, including smell. And again, here's the differences. We human beings, we all experience supernatural realities in different ways. And what was that smell? Was it like a physical smell? Or does it even matter that it was or wasn't a physical smell? If it was a spiritual smell, what does that say about the spiritual dimension and our ability to perceive it? So, yeah, your own description of it raises all sorts of questions about the fact, and it is a fact, that in the history of Christian mysticism, mystics have had all different sorts of experiences that can be classified as mystical. So I've long believed and became convinced a long time ago when I started to study religion as an academic, as a scholar, that without mystics, new religions are not established. To put it the other way, you need mystics and you need people who have mystical experiences to get religions going and to maintain them through time. These people kind of prove in various ways that the spiritual dimension is real.
Well, for our listeners out there, go back through your memories, because many of you may have had a mystical experience and didn't even know you have had one. But getting back to the topic of our episode, you mentioned she was an Anglican, but she did a lot of reading and did a lot of studying on the church fathers, who were obviously Catholic, taking into consideration the less than stellar relationship between the Anglican church and the Catholic church. Did that present any problems for her?
You know, there was remarkably little resistance that mattered in any real way. Yeah, there were, of course, you know, those who were in the Anglican community were not all that appreciative of her efforts to reincorporate the mystical tradition into Anglican spirituality or Anglican piety. Yeah, there were those who resisted. But the most astounding thing about her success, and let's label it success, right? She broke through. You know, we like to speak, you know, when it comes to women, of the glass ceiling, right? She broke through multiple glass ceilings, not just as a woman and as a layperson, but as an Anglican whose work and her presence brought all of this Catholic piety back into the Anglican fold officially. I mean, she led retreats sponsored by the Anglican Church. She taught Anglican clergy. She preached to Anglican clergy. So, yeah, there was resistance. There always is to things of this nature when you make any change. As a matter of fact, I had this description once given to me by an Anglican clergyman. Said, you know, one of the most difficult things about being a clergy person is that no matter what you do, you're always offending someone. And he was speaking very precisely about his own his rural Anglican church in Virginia. And he said, I've got members of my congregation that if I simply change the angle of the pews, some will start crying and some will start accusing me of not heresy, but of ruining the Anglican tradition just by changing the angle of the pews. So yeah, she had resistance, but it didn't matter. She prevailed, and prevailed spectacularly.
Well, considering she was an Anglican and a contemporary of C.S. Lewis, do you know if they ever spoke or had any...
Oh, gee, that's a great question. That's a great question. Well, I don't know, to be perfectly honest. But, you know, C.S. Lewis was great friends with J.R.R. Tolkien, who was Catholic. And Lewis himself was somewhat like Evelyn Underhill in his respect and admiration of many of these traditional Christian values, right, that were in place before the Protestant Reformation came along. So I think it's highly likely. I would need to look this up to see if the two actually ever were in conversation or knew each other. But I think the friendship between Tolkien and Lewis is a sign of the fact that things were changing in the Anglican community in the first half of the 20th century. And it helps explain why, you know, even though some resisted Underhill's influence, she prevailed because things were changing.
Well, considering her notoriety and popularity and all that she accomplished, I would imagine that they at least ran into each other or had some type of communication.
Oh, I'm sure. And they obviously, I mean, they would have known of each other's work.
Exactly.
That's at a minimum. Yeah.
So when we started the podcast, you mentioned she had written a lot.
Yeah. Well, actually, before she started writing on mysticism when she was very young, she wrote 3 novels. But then she gave up on the fiction and started in 1911 with her work on mysticism and never stopped. Mysticism, a study of the nature and development of man's spiritual consciousness, was the long title of this 1911 book, which is still being read over a century later. And she was writing in 1911 from a perspective that was, let's put it, less Catholic. It was more philosophical, psychological, still spiritual, but more philosophical and psychological approach to a universal phenomenon. And then she gradually became ever more focused on the Catholic nature of most of medieval and early modern mysticism, but wrote very, very much as a believer from the very beginning in 1911. But in this book, she proposed that mysticism is practical, not theoretical. So from the very beginning, see, she's taking this tack, this perspective, that this is not about a theory. This is not about intellectual, rational approaches to the divine. No, mysticism is practical, not theoretical. Mysticism is an entirely spiritual activity, she said in 1911. But then she went even further and said, the business and method of mysticism is love. And also, mysticism entails a definite psychological experience. And this business about a psychological experience, she was, of course, writing with William James in mind. Who was William James? William James is a pioneering American psychologist, taught at Harvard, who wrote a very, very influential book, The Varieties of Religious Experience. And James took the psychological dimension of religion very, very seriously, not as a materialist, but as someone who thought that, yes, religious experience is part of human nature and human psychology. So she probably had this very much in mind, but she disagreed with him on several points. But the most important thing about this 1911 book is that with this book, Underhill placed mysticism in two spheres simultaneously, the spiritual religious sphere and the psychological sphere, as something that is part and parcel of human experience. And add to this the fact that she, from 1911 on, argued that these experiences were real. So in addition, in this book, she mapped out mysticism as a journey that goes through five phases. Now, traditionally, mysticism had been mapped out as having three phases: purgation, illumination, union. So she put a little more texture into this journey. The first stage was an awakening of the self. What does that mean, an awakening of the self? That, you know, you begin to gain an awareness of your situation as a human being and as a distinct person, you know, different from others, but still embedded in the same sorts of challenges and difficulties as every other human being, but it's you. But you also become aware of the fact that yourself is so limited. So you move on to the second, which is purgation of self. And the third step is illumination. So what she's done already is she's added that first step, awakening of self, precedes purgation of self, then followed by illumination. And then the fourth stage, she gets straight out of St. John of the Cross, The Dark Night of the Soul, which precedes the fifth and final stage of the journey, union. And about union, she proposed that union produced a glorious and fruitful creativeness, and that the mystic who attains union, who attains this final perfectness, becomes a very active doer. In other words, the mystic does not become a reclusive, dreaming lover of God. No, the mystic becomes very active. And in this, I see an echo of Teresa of Avila. Of course she read her. Of course she read John of the Cross. Teresa says very much the same thing. You become super active because you're being infused with supernatural grace as a result of this. So this last point, the fact that mysticism is about doing in this world, of becoming very active in the world, this would become the centerpiece of her own spirituality, her own take on mysticism, perhaps her own mysticism. And it would give structure to all of her work, including her pastoral work, because she got involved in speaking to clergy, speaking to lay people, leading retreats so that people would embark on this journey, but always emphasizing the fact, this is not about you. This journey is not about you. Or let me put it differently. Forget about me. You're me. Forget about yourself. That's what this journey is about. This journey is not about you. It's about encountering God. And then once you have this encounter, it's about being selfless and devoting yourself to others. And that's the side of Evelyn Underhill that you find when you read her letters and when you read the talks that she prepared for these retreats and the talks that she gave to Anglican clergy. That's where you encounter it.
And did she write strictly on mysticism, or did she write on other topics?
Mostly she wrote on mysticism. And she also wrote not necessarily on Christian mystics. She wrote a book in 1919 on Plotinus, the founder of Neoplatonism, for instance. And Plotinus, not Christian, but she acknowledged the fact that Augustine had been a Neoplatonist. And she quotes Augustine very often in her work. Also, in 1914, on Jan van Ruusbroeck, who was a disciple of Meister Eckhart. And in 1925, she published another book, The Mystics of the Church. And literally, dozens of books and essays and these meditations that she prepared for retreats. And there's one book of hers that was also very early. Forget the exact date. It was after 1911, just a few years after 1911. You know, basically, mysticism for normal, everyday people. She was one of these experts on mysticism who didn't limit it to monastics who devote their entire lives to the mystical pursuits. She was pretty much on the same wavelength as Meister Eckhart, or at least one of Meister Eckhart's sermons, in which he says, I'm talking about Eckhart, that you can break through to God while shoeing a horse. You can find God in the world. Or as Teresa of Avila put it in a different way, God walks among the pots and pans in the kitchen. You know, it's mysticism for life, the mysticism of everyday life, not just of these, you know, unitive encounters with the divine. No, it suffuses everything in life and turns people into very, very active and very loving people. Lives are transformed by these encounters.
You mentioned she wrote meditations.
Yeah, these have been published in various ways since they were written by her. And there are various ways that one can access these. One collection of these meditations is The Ways of the Spirit, published in 1990, which contains the meditations that she wrote for some of these retreats. There are other books that contain also other meditations. But if anyone wants to get taste of this, and I would like to read some of the passages from here, but if anyone wants to get a taste of undiluted Evelyn Underhill, the mystic, these meditations are the best place to go. Let me read some of these, because we'll get away from abstractions to real things. And these meditations all have different themes. And one of them, the theme being redemption. This is what she has to say. Redemption does not mean you and me made safe and popped into heaven. It means that each soul redeemed from self-interest by the revelation of divine love is taken and used again for the spread of that redeeming work. And that's the theme that I mentioned before, very central to her work.
You can really sense the asceticism in that meditation.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, she was very keen on this self-annihilation. She actually says in several places that I've read where she speaks of, you know, annihilating yourself, turning yourself over into an instrument of God's love for the world. And I read the introduction to this book from which I'm reading right now by Grace Adolphson Brame. She speaks of the ways in which in the 1920s, especially, Evelyn Underhill went through a lot of serious self-denial of a spiritual sort that caused her some of her previous relationships with friends, her husband, to undergo a lot of stress. When people change in this way, it's always possible that the people who are closest to you will react negatively to the changes that you're undertaking. But in her writing from the 1920s forward, she became very focused on what holiness is, what sainthood is, and the relationship between holiness, sainthood, prayer, and self-denial. So, yeah, very traditional approach to the mystical journey. Now, some more passages. What is sanctity on that theme of sanctity? What is sanctity? Just the perfection of our love, its growth towards God and others. The more we love, the better is our work. Even if we are only doorkeepers in the house of God, the more likely we are to attract others to the door. Pure love or charity, that utter self-giving of the creature, which is the human reply to the love of God, that is the same as sanctity. And on that very same theme, sanctity, which she calls the perfection of love, she says, this is why, if we love and desire to give ourselves to God, we are bound to give ourselves also to the whole world. Otherwise, we should divide off our personal experience of God from his greatness and infinite presence, and so turn what ought to be a dedication into a private enjoyment. So much for self-obsessed or self-absorbed mystics. I had a student say this to me once in class, and I think I might have mentioned it before. I was somewhat puzzled by mystical texts, like by the fourth or fifth week of the class. Came up to me and said, Professor, I'm a little confused because all these texts, the writers keep talking about selflessness, but these are the most self-obsessed people I have ever read. There's that paradox that she's focusing on here. That in fact, no, this is not about being happy or having the equivalent of, you know, a high from some drug. No, this is about changing and being selfless and doing for others. And again, on sanctity, I ran across this passage today, which I, of course, I had read before, but this time it jumped out at me. She says, if in the next life we could feel sure of being met by even one soul who said to us, through you, God found me, I think that would be sufficient for our beatitude. And I don't think that, if it happens, the soul will be one that we consciously tried to instruct in Christian doctrine. It will be someone who noticed our certitude and our joy. And that term beatitude, that's a traditional theological term for what we experience in heaven for eternity. Beatitude. Meeting someone in heaven who says, through you, God found me. That is beatitude. And again, in this passage, she says that if in fact you do meet any such person, it's not somebody you've been teaching Christian doctrine to, it's just someone who saw joy and certitude radiating from you. And if anyone wants to say, oh, this woman's not a mystic, well, read this passage. And on prayer, here's what she had to say. One of the many things that she had to say. We are spiritual creatures with the power of communion with God, breathing the air of eternity. We can't keep this power unless we exercise it, nor can we fully get it unless we train ourselves to it. We must accustom our attention that wanders over all other interests to fix itself on God. Such deliberate attention to God is the beginning of real prayer. Prayer is never to be judged by feeling that goes with it. It is the willed intercourse of our tiny spirits with the infinite spirit of love. We are spiritual creatures a repeat, because this is so, to me, so revealing of her own mysticism. We are spiritual creatures with the power of communion with God, breathing the air of eternity. But you have to exercise, you have to train, you have to pray, you have to make an effort.
Listening to these meditations, it takes me back to all the mystics that we've spoken about over the last year and a few months. You just see this selflessness, this total abandonment to God. So you can really see how her study of the mystics did affect and influenced her.
Oh, very much so. And how, you know, you can also see in these retreats, which were carried out within the Anglican Church, right? You can see the way that this is also, from one perspective, you can see it as very 20th century adaptation of these mystical texts that she has read so deeply and of whatever mystical experiences that she has had. And the people who attend these retreats and the people who come away from these retreats, you know, perhaps supercharged by these meditations, they're lay people. They're not monks and nuns. So it's very 20th century. It's very lay oriented. And it has absolutely no mention in any of the pages of these meditations. You must leave the world. You must flee the world. No, it's just the opposite. You have to get engaged with the world. And on communion with Christ, because so far I think the texts that I have read only refer to God, but she's also very Christ-centered and very Christocentric. This passage on communion turns everything that we've been speaking about and the passages that I've been reading, turns them into a very Christocentric lesson. She says, we, as cells of the body of Christ, that's very 20th century. We, as cells of the body of Christ, are called upon to be channels of his mystical self-imparting. Our lives, gestures, words, and small acts should be outward and visible signs of inward spiritual grace. If so, how continuous, faithful, and humbling our communion with him must be, and how alert and ready to find him we must be in every moment of our lives. That is Evelyn Underhill, the Christocentric mystic, at her very, very best. On the topic of encountering the divine, and one of these retreats was based on the visions of Isaiah, the prophet in the Old Testament, and St. Francis. She says, isn't this experience, this rift in the veil, this amazing vision of reality, of the glory of God, this sense of love and awe awakened, isn't it much the same for Isaiah and Francis? Both have their eyes opened on reality, the majestic vision of creative will, but the results are not the same. For it is only when the willing sacrifice of the human is seen along with the glory of and love of God as a part of his beauty that we get the proportions of existence right. When the holy rift comes into our close-knit, everyday existence, when we get a veritable glimpse of God in the natural order, the Spirit of love will come to us bearing the image of a person crucified, an invitation to courage, sacrifice, and love.
A very impressive woman and accomplished some amazing things, not only for being a layperson, being a woman in the early 20th century, but it's impossible to look at her life, look at her writings, look at what she accomplished and not be impressed.
Yeah, I agree.
So who do you have for us on the next episode?
We will stay in the 20th century and look at a very different mystic, Padre Pio, who is now Saint Pio. Padre Pio died in 1968, and growing up as a child, I heard stories about Padre Pio growing up Catholic. He was still alive. I knew of people who traveled to Italy just to see him, just to go to confession with him. So we can't get much closer to 2024 than Padre Pio.
Well, I've been anxiously awaiting that episode.
Good, good. And I think many of our listeners have too.
I agree. Well, another great episode, Carlos. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you to all our listeners for your support. And until the next time, thank you for listening to the Christian Mysticism Podcast. If you have any questions for Dr. Ayer, you'll find our email address in the show notes. Just send it over and we'll try to answer it in a future episode. And don't forget to click the subscribe button so you don't miss the next episode of the Christian Mysticism Podcast.